Welcome to Future of Journalism, a podcast from the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism. I'm Mitali Mukherjee, Acting Director and Director of Journalist Programs at the Reuters Institute. Today, we're sharing an important conversation that we held at the Institute around how audiences globally consume climate news, what they think of it, and some of the challenges that news organizations face in making their journalism really land. The discussion followed publication of our Climate Change and News Audiences report, now in its third year, that explores these very issues. Even as 2024 was the hottest year on record, a key theme emerging from this year's findings is climate perception inertia, a stagnation in political views on, attitudes to, and engagement with climate issues and information over time, despite the growing urgency of the crisis. Joining me to discuss all this and more were an expert panel made up of Catherine Dunn, content editor at our Oxford Climate Journalism Network, Ivan Kurun, who is the global editor of AFP's Future of the Planet desk, and Dr. Bikas Ijaz, research fellow and lead author of our climate news report. I began by asking Bikas for his main takeaways from the research around this topic, having tracked climate news consumption for the past 3 years.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I think the one thing that stood out, and we have highlighted in the report as well, was how remarkably stable people have been, both in terms of engaging with the topic of climate change and how their attitudes have been over the past 3 years, because this is what we have been doing. Across 3 years, we have been looking into different ideas on how people engage with climate change as a topic and then what it does to them. While, for example, consuming news, does it happens when you consume news or it doesn't? And we have, over the period of time, we have covered a range of different issues. And what, for me, which stood out this year was in the backdrop of increased intensity of extreme weather events, increased frequency of extreme weather events, 2023 being the, on record, the hottest year ever recorded. And then 2024 was again topped, or 2023 record as well. So in the backdrop of such drastic changes that we are seeing, I did not see that among people. There was a disconnect, what I felt, that people have kind of stopped paying attention, the urgency of the crisis, or probably they have sort of a ceiling effect that's the best people could come up with in terms of engaging with that topic. So that was, I guess, my sort of a surprise, a main finding. And now that I have, you know, published the work, we are now looking a bit deeper into why, what are the different reasons could have been to explain such inertia, which is what we are calling climate perception inertia in the report. So this is how I sort of say that this is one key takeaway for me on the report.
Yeah. Mentioning and outlining, that's the double-edged sword of it, isn't it? It's still sort of 3/4 of respondents saying they do believe this is important, but the fact that for the 3 years we've been tracking this data, it hasn't moved. And as you say, in the face of extreme weather events, not just heat, but also flooding, also fires to some degree, it's quite surprising to see that sort of response. For the network and for the 700 journalists that we speak with about climate on a daily basis, is this something you're hearing sort of echoed across newsrooms saying, I get it, it does feel like the biggest story of our lifetimes, but it doesn't seem to be moving ahead?
Yeah, it was interesting because when I saw the results of the study, I did think, it's not just like vibes. No, it really is this feeling of, you know, why are we struggling to breakthrough. Yeah. And I think what we have with a lot of newsrooms, what's notable is that we're a self-selecting group, right? People apply to the OCJ because they want to deal with this. They want to report on this. So we get very enthusiastic people. And there are some real standout newsrooms. Ivan's going to talk about AFP, where we see a real difference. But for a lot of the newsrooms, in a way, we are still hearing the same things that we heard back in 2022 when we started, which is that people come in, you know, Russia invaded Ukraine, full-scale invasion, and at the start of the OCJN. And we had people coming in saying, my editors say this isn't interesting, saying we have bigger problems, saying people aren't interested. Like, I think a lot of these are actually myths or things that we have to dissect a little bit more, but they're very, very, very pervasive and they are affecting climate journalism. And in that sense, it's no different than what we were hearing 3 years ago. Definitely, there are some bright spots. People are coming out, they're doing something different, they're trying something different. And compared to 3 years ago, we have a lot of answers. We have a lot of tangible things we can point people to. And that's what's really different. But that is also frustrating, honestly, because we have really, really tangible examples and we have newsrooms that are doing it successfully and it's working. So there's no excuse anymore, really. Yeah. And I think I'm going to do a shout out to our colleague, Greg Cochran, who works with the alumni. We were talking yesterday, and Greg is an amazing journalist who works on climate and culture and music. And, you know, he's one of the only people who works at this intersection. And he was talking about how, you know, in the lead up, the Grammys, the fiery, nobody was saying the words climate change. And that is like really hard to grapple with. How can you have a city be, you know, have parts of it raised to the ground and nobody is saying these words? So, yeah I think it should be a moment of reflection.
Yeah,
actually.
And a moment of comparison, Ivan, because you've got countries like France where engagement amongst our respondents seem to be much higher at the higher end, whereas you have a country like the US that's probably emerged from, let's say, a somewhat toxic relationship with political news and the elections, and climate news engagement has actually dropped off a cliff. Interestingly, that's something that gets echoed in our data from Germany as well, where you are beginning to see a much less sort of relationship between the audience and climate than we saw even 2 years back. What is France doing right?
France, interesting. I think the landscape in France has changed very recently. In the past, everything happened in the past 2 to 3 years. In the past 2 to 3 years, a lot of news organizations in France, and in 2022, we had major heat waves in France. Yeah. But I think that impacted the public's perception of climate. And at the same time, in the past 2 years, major news organizations, broadcasters, adopted a climate strategy, but a full corporate editorial climate strategy. They appointed climate editors, they restructured, reorganized their newsroom. And now every night on French TV at 8 p.m., evening news, the top two channels, you have climate, good quality climate content every single day. Yep. So it's changing. And also, one thing I was intrigued in the report is that television news is on top. Yeah. Isn't it amazing? So that tells me the old world isn't dead, yeah. Right? Legacy media. So, and what was the number? I think 50%.
50%.
Said is somewhat or strongly trust new news media for information on climate. Yeah. So it's not massive. But it's still something, right?
Ivan, let me draw you in on that, which is, and you and I spoke, you know, a few weeks back about heat, for example, the fact that newsrooms weren't quite equipped to be handling the kind of heat in which they were reporting. What can we do to provide sort of newness and nuance and something for someone who isn't engaged with the news, but might, as one believes, be part of the younger generation that is engaged with climate?
No, I think right. I think people can feel that sometimes it's repetitive. No one wants to read the same story twice, or better than three, four, five times. So I always say the most important climate event of the year for the media is not COP. It's the summer. This is what we have to prepare for.
Yeah.
So I'm not preparing COP at all right now. I'm preparing the summer.
Yeah.
So news organizations should have a plan. We know there's going to be extreme weather event this summer, and summer is already in the southern hemisphere right now. Summer in the northern hemisphere is starting. You can have a heat wave in April, right?
Yeah.
So there's a list of things you should do. Do you have guidelines, like written guidelines for your newsroom, not just for your climate reporters, but for the people who are going to cover the flooding or the heat wave?
Or covering an election rally in the middle of June, which is sort of intense.
Yes. Or you will have an education reporter who's going to cover schools closing because it's too hot. So have you trained your journalists? Have you talked to your business editors, your political editors? Because they're going to cover it. This is, it's going to be breaking news when schools close and when there's a disaster and the government response is not up to the task. So you have to prepare all of this. And there's a lot of safety also. And this is something we at AFP we're developing very, very strongly. Like literally, how are you going to dress when you're going to cover that fire? Like what kind of clothes do you have to wear? How do you park your car near a fire? So we have our own guidelines. I mean, a lot of organizations do. But how much water do you take when you go in Brazil cover a flood? Like for how many days do you take food? How are you going to recharge your batteries? All of this. This needs to be prepared.
And Kat, this is the interesting one, which is that, again, in the research that we conducted, we found there was a greater preference for local news. But I think I would broaden that to actually imply personal relevance. And I want to do a mea culpa because I'm the one who always says, every story is a climate story, a business story is certainly a climate story. Does it feel like that's not the case when you speak to journalists, that it's not sort of, I can't insert climate everywhere, but I can bring personal relevance to a story and then engage with the climate side of it?
I still think most stories can be a climate story. It's all just about maybe I'm like, not every story. No, not every story, but a little, a line. Often when we're telling people put more climate and they think, well, this and the angle, and they say, it's a line. You know, the LA fires, maybe every story, it'll be a practical stuff, insurance, it'll be about all this stuff. Sometimes all you need is a line. Sometimes it is such low hanging fruit. And like, I have a connection there, but I want to go back to like, what Yvonne said, which is, so last year we did an annual event on heat, and I thought I knew about heat, but I was like, oh, wow, this is not just this is bad, but this is something we can prepare for and something we should prepare for. And for newsrooms where we try not to be prescriptive about what they should do, one of the things we started like really saying is like develop a heat strategy. Climate might feel really bad, big, really political, really complex, but start with heat, because I want to know, it's July 4th. I want to know, can I go for a run? Will my dog go into heat stroke if I take him out? Is somebody's pregnant? Should they go outside? Like, these are really, really, really tangible choices that people are making about their health. And that is why we need heat coverage. And so I'm Canadian. I'm from Western Canada. Wildfire coverage. Like, what boots do you need? The Aussies have figured this out, but like, you need your boots not to melt. That's the kind. In California, they were wearing the wrong masks. They need to be wearing, go to Home Depot and get the right mask. Like, this is stuff we can prepare for. We should prepare for. It is dangerous, but is also the stuff that like, it is a life and death issue, right? And for public broadcasters, this is like what we are there to do at the end of the day. And like, we need to be giving people that information. And if climate feels too big and too complicated, start with heat. And also, you can do buildings, you can do infrastructure, you can do sports. We did loads on the Olympics last summer. Yeah. How did the Olympics train, the Olympians train if Paris was only 40 degrees? Like, they all had to train. They had to prepare to not pass out on the tennis court.
Yeah.
So it's just really, really, really tangible. And I think also it goes back to local news. When people say they want local news, they're not getting it because the media ecosystem, they're saying they want stuff that's useful.
Yeah.
Tell me, can I take my dog for a walk? Like, how scared do I need to be if I'm pregnant and it's 40 degrees?
Like food inflation, right?
What happens
to the prices of food and vegetables and why? So did you want to come in on a point?
Yeah, so climate, okay, is part of every story, but let's be very careful when we write because you don't want a legal disclaimer kind of effect at the end of, at the bottom of a story. A scientist like climate change, blah, blah, blah. Maybe people will, we're in a different time today, and I think we have to be careful about the language. And I think one way to address that is to be very concrete and say, okay, the Gulf of Mexico has never been hotter. And this is how it's feeding the intensity of storms. And this is much more efficient, and it's less... maybe for some readers it's going to be more acceptable as language and as efficient. I think it's win-win because you explain the mechanism without talking about climate change in general, which might seem abstract and some people may, you know, become scared.
Yeah. So not everything is, but some events are climate facing, such as COP with us, and we were, you know, quite interested and intrigued to see what the data would look like, because while the survey was out was when COP was actually underway. So you would think there was a lot bubbling in terms of news and intonation, but there were two sort of I don't want to say downers, but two learnings, one on COP engagement and the other on how young people perceive COP. For the sake of our, you know, online audience, I am going to rattle off some of those numbers again, and then we can talk a bit about it, which is that on average across 8 countries, 14% had never heard of COP, 21% acknowledged they had heard but knew nothing about it, a majority, 61%, said they did know something about it. And within the young respondents, they were more likely to view COP positively. But I think it's important to say that a notable 53% of that young population, which is 18 to 24, still view COP as a major failure for the climate, a sentiment that sort of tended to increase with age.
Yeah, I think COP is really interesting. We do a lot of preparation with the members on COP and how to, and we get them to invite their editors and planning conversations. And people are going to do it really differently, right, if they're specialists or they're not. But I also think, you know, the last few COPs were maybe not the best and rallying moment. They felt a little...
Oh, diplomacy, yes.
Yeah, you know, the whole, you know, a lot of fossil fuel, you know, a lot of suppression of civil society wasn't a great vibe, I would say. I think expectations going into this last one were incredibly, incredibly low. But yes, I think one of the things that I always think about with the DNR and past reports is sometimes some of the COP coverage, it's replicating some of the elements of political journalism that in every single digital news report, audiences are saying they do not like. Mm-hmm. So what, you know, we know climate's can be a very difficult topic. We know politics right now is a very difficult topic. Why are we using the same formula? It is their North American term, inside baseball. It is really, you know, if you're running, if you're working for a political blog, a climate blog, you can get in the weeds. But for regular people, this is photos of Boris Johnson. This is people meeting. They may as well be covering G7 in Davos with an apocalypse sort of tone to it all. It's just, you know, like a live blog on COP. I just not waste your money or time. Watch the big themes. We tell people go and source, go and get loads of ideas. But like, it's got to feel local. It's got to feel tangible. And I think if we could trade out a few less COP stories for a few more local biodiversity stories, stories that sometimes editors think are actually quite soft and fluffy. We talk to scientists over and over and over again, and they say for the lowest hanging fruit that will make the biggest difference tomorrow, go out into your local community and write a local biodiversity story about somebody restoring their local park. And you might think it sounds like, what difference will that make? We'll all be dead tomorrow, you know, forget it. No, like these are the stories that actually have a lot of science behind them. And I think if you read these stories, you do feel better. So that's what I would say about COP. We're not going to stop doing them. They're big geopolitical themes and there's loads of money. But yeah, throwing all of our eggs in the COP basket, I don't think is...
And I think what you're saying goes right back to the point in the report as well, authored by Vikas, which is about personal relevance. Ivan, I want to talk a little bit about how to tell these stories, because that's the other takeaway. Just as we've seen with our larger audience surveys, it is video that is the most popular form, and this sort of cuts across age groups that we looked at. It is short form video that they seem to be engaging with more. Is that the syntax we need to be thinking about when we're talking about climate?
Yeah, I mean, and also you have to think, we have to make sure we do stories that robots won't be able to do, right? So you have to be on the ground and, you know, because you still need humans to shoot that story and take pictures. And so, I mean, I can only talk about what we do.
Yeah.
We try and always send, you know, a text reporter and a photographer and a VJ on every assignment. Because that's what the media want, right? They want a very visual story. So we kind of split between the impact stories, climate change impact stories, and responses. But this is really hard to find original angles, right? Because I think there's boring news avoidance Like you don't want to do always the same stories. And this is where it's really hard. And so you need to build literacy in your newsroom. You need to train them. You need to have guidelines. You need to go. We have a checklist at AFP. Well, is this a real response to climate change? Is it replicable? Is it, I mean, it's basically inspired by solutions journalism, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah. And use a lot of data as well.
Yeah, it's a good segue, Vikas, to talk about our findings on misinformation. I know that a lot of the scientific community we've been interacting with has sort of felt it more keenly, I think, in the last year and a half, the kind of pushback they faced on climate-related conversations or climate-related research. What did we find around misinformation specifically?
It's a very, very hot thing to talk about misinformation in general. And then climate misinformation is also kind of something that people would want to know about, because a lot of the time we attribute inaction on, be it on the governmental side or on people's behavior change, we attribute this to, they must have come across some sort of misinformation on climate change. Oh, there is no climate, there is no consensus among scientists, so on and so forth. So we wanted to, we have been doing it for the last 3 years. Across the years, it's stagnant. Whoever believed in all those climate-related misinformation, I wouldn't say he's the same person, but that person continues, or a similar kind of percentage is across 3 years at aggregate level. And when we look at within countries, things do not change. So people who were, for example, some countries are very much, more people were like, we are exposed to misinformation on climate change in high 40s. They continue to be the same case. But I think it's worth mentioning sort of the caveat here is this is the perceived misinformation. You know, I think this, the information I'm getting is a misinformation. So I'm not 100% sure, because the follow-up question to this we normally ask is, how much do you think that you have come across? You know, how frequently you come across. And we don't have, on average, it's like 20-25% people say that I come across climate misinformation frequently. So it is out there. It is in different pockets of our information ecosystem. I won't diminish its impact, but I don't exaggerate it as well. It is not, we need to talk about that. But if you ask me honestly, there are very few people in very few places with very few attributes in common who are both engaging with that kind of information, consume that kind of information, and then spread it across the information landscape.
And I think it's worth mentioning for some of these countries like India, in general, levels of concern around misinformation are very high.
Yep.
India and South Africa, as we found consistently. So it seems to sort of also extend into climate-related news. I'm going to pause with my questions because there's a whole bunch of them coming in online. And thank you to Diego Arguedas Ortiz, who runs the Oxford Climate Network, for sort of supporting with sending these questions across. Glad to have you here in presence in some sort. Muriel Thornton, and I know, Vikas, this is something we debated last year, has a question around, could you discuss how audience responds to coverage of climate activism?
We had it.
Did you, Germany?
We looked at this specifically, and we had, Just Stop Oil and the protests around that. So what we called direct action, not we, but GSO, Just Stop Oil themselves, termed them as, disruptive protests or direct action protests. We also have some of the questions in this, but we haven't really published that in the report. We'll be doing that later on. I think overall, such protests are not very much welcomed among public. There is a very strong opposition. Majority of people, and when I say majority, I mean we're talking about more than 60-65% people who are not supportive of such disruptive direct action protests. It doesn't really matter how, is it throwing soup on sunflower or is it gluing yourself on the road? This is not the way people see this. And some countries are more, have more strong opinion towards that compared to the others. for example, Germany being, it's a 2 years data, and we still see that Germans are somehow, they are very against this idea of disruption. And we continue to look into this, and I think there is a lot to unpack here, but I hope that I have the answer, because I can't really go much into the detail how people normally, you know, have much more nuanced information. There's one bit more, perhaps, is that we ask people, do they think that media covers their coverage of such events fairly or not? Well, this is also something that people consider, that media's criticism on such events is fair. So because those who support, who do not support such activism, they also think media is covering these events as fairly, regardless how negative or how critical that coverage is. Mm-hmm. So that kind of aligns with people's expectation on the activism side.
I did have something to say where we're now, it feels, and I've heard this in very like off, you know, behind the scenes conversations sometimes with people very senior at news organizations, where they will talk about the level of disinformation they get. They will talk about the level of harassment the reporters get. Everything will be picked and they'll get these horrible messages on Twitter. And you know, it is interesting sometimes as you're hearing this, and this is not a nice experience. And obviously news organizations should think about how to keep their reporters safe. But I also think there is a danger, even among a lot of news organizations, about conflating the people who spend loads and loads of time spreading disinformation and harassing journalists online as being a sizable part of the news audience. Because I think in the report there, it says like how many people, what percentage of people actually do not believe that climate change is happening. And am I wrong in saying something like 8%? It's really small.
Very low.
Is really small, and that number includes the United States. Well, you know, come on, right? They're probably skewing the
numbers. She's not saying that because she's Canadian. She,
no, but like, look at that. Look at the numbers in the United States. I talked to Yvonne on the way here. Like, it's so polarized too. We're all consuming bucket loads of American political news every day. I'm not saying that's the wrong choice, but we're doing it. We're just like taking a shower in it, and sometimes we're forgetting how extreme the U.S. is. And how extreme the polarization is, and how extreme the disinformation coming from the top. And we are conflating being loud with being a large majority of people. So I have spoken to news bosses where they basically say that they try not to do that much climate coverage because the blowback is so bad. And I'm thinking, well, you're letting a bunch of really angry retired people dictate your news strategy. I mean, come on. We know people care. We know it's hard for them to think about. We know it can be depressing and lack novelty, but they do care and they do believe in this stuff. So, you know, that is something I would say is some, I do think it's really important. And usually it's coming from the top, not some retired guy online. Like, let's be clear where it's coming from. But I would not let that derail your strategy. I would try to build a climate strategy for the people who actually matter, which is the vast majority of your audience, over 90%. So that's what I say about disability.
Yeah. And
I really got like zapped up.
I was just going to say, you would be surprised how many old and retired people there are in India. Some of them go on to have political careers. And then many of them find their way on social media. We have
nothing against the retired people.
No, man.
We love that. They consume a lot of careers.
So we have like only about 8 or 9 minutes left. And I want to hold this space for you to express, you know, your thoughts about this. And I think the one that I want to hold on to is that it is still the case that the news media is responsible for the bulk of people's engagement with climate news and information. And I hold that personally quite close. Because, you know, what do we want news publishers to take away from this? And it's the same question for all of you.
Well, this seems like a very easy question, but very difficult to take on. And I have been asked this question many, many times. Honestly, the right answer would be there is no one size-fits-all solution here. You have to, I think if there's one thing that news organization can pivot is just focus on your audience specifically, that those audience analytics would tell you a lot. Because I have heard people from, I have been in a room with people from Denmark, and they have told me, the editor have told me the fascinating story, how a long form journalistic piece about how to build a sustainable house in Denmark has done tremendously well against, I mean, I would say I personally thought that long form journalism is pretty much gone now. But he explained to me that how detailed the piece was, in a sense that how to source the lumber from, how to get the sustainable choices to buy things from in order to make a sustainable house in Denmark. I mean, come on. In Denmark, you expect people are already very, you know, conscious about environmental issues. But still, they wanted to pay attention to these things. So I think it is very much audience-centric. It should be. I mean, you can't have one kind of story works across contexts. I have seen that in Pakistan as well. People do not want to, you know, and journalists actually, this is, I mean, I know a lot of journalists won't like it, but they people can see through the rehashing of climate stories. And I have people confided with me that this is what they have been doing. And that's partly the reason that people are kind of disengaging, or sometimes they do not feel like reading that. So I would say that if focus on your audience, if you have an audience of young people, they would want to know the solution, what to do, and very hyper-local context, despite this being a global issue, but the solutions and what how to talk about this comes from a very, very, like you mentioned, it comes from very localized contexts.
It's clear the media is in the worst crisis of its modern history, for sure. But people still believe in truth, and we see it in your reports, right? The proportion of people that trust scientists is the highest, right? There's some countries that's really high. So people trust scientists. It feels like everything is changing. We're in a cultural revolution where there's no more truth or lies, but actually, no, people believe in truth. And so this is, we have to adapt, we have to change, clearly, or we won't survive. We have AI, there's a lot of things that are changing. And there's a lot of problems with, you know, we're attacked, harassed, but still people believe in, we have to fight. I mean, the value of truth is still there, right? Still a lot of people want it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, like something I kind of say over and over and over again, but like we're going to cover climate change, and it doesn't matter how chaotic and awful, I should not be honest, Trump is, but like we're still going to cover it because Los Angeles was still on fire and Pakistan was still underwater, and these are still huge stories. So we've had a choice for the last several years, and we still face a choice, like, we're going to cover them. So are you going to do it well? You have to do it. Why don't you do it better? And also, I would say, you know, from Ivan, we're having this conversation, whereas it's actually interesting because there's a lot of, when people are putting the time, the resources and the effort in, they're experimenting a lot with climate journalism. And when we figure out some of these things on climate journalism, when we can figure out climate stories that do really, really well, which NRK in Norway, again, like an insanely popular story about the climate and the sea that every single person in Norway apparently read 5 times. It was crazy. Once these stories do well, what was my point? I lost.
What should new publish mistakes leave from
point?
I think climate journalists are rethinking the way they do journalism like crazy. And it's been happening for years, right? Everyone's is up to solutions journalism. Yeah, I don't think political journalism or foreign affairs journalism, or the way we cover conflicts, geopolitics, diplomacy.
Yeah, and they're in a crisis too. I mean, come on, we're all in a crisis together, let's be honest. But we see that political journalism is really in a crisis. And if we can figure some of this out, we can experiment, use some of these things, push back against some of the conventions, you know, then the political desk can start following what we're doing. And I think that would be great.
I think the slider may have ended somewhere between optimistic and pessimistic. But thank you to my panelists. I think we're out of time for our online conversation.
Thank you all for listening to this episode of Future of Journalism. The report that much of this discussion was based on is available to read in full on our website, and you can go through both the executive summary and, of course, the more detailed takeaways. Look out for more episodes coming soon on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And if you don't want to miss any news from the Institute, subscribe to our weekly newsletter. You can find the link on our Blue Sky bio or on our homepage. And of course, you can follow us and subscribe to our daily update on LinkedIn. This was Future of Journalism, podcast by the Reuters Institute. I'm Mitali Mukherjee. We'll be back soon.